If there is such a thing as a holy grail in cancer research, a secret spell or golden ring that can ward off any and all forms of the disease, it probably lives somewhere in the realm of immunotherapy.
The thinking for over 100 years had been, if you could just get the immune system to attack the cancer, that would be wonderful. And so lots of ways were tried, but none of those had worked.
That's Dana-Farber's Gordon Freeman. He may not have found that golden ring, but he got a very good look at it. Gordon Freeman discovered the PD-1/PD-L1 pathway. It's a pathway involving two proteins, one on the surface of a T cell, our first line of defense, the other on the surface of a cancer cell. Freeman saw that when these proteins bind, they trigger a checkpoint in the T cell. As a result, instead of attacking the cancer cell, the foreign invader, the T cell shuts down. And instead of being killed, the tumor cell slips past unharmed to grow and multiply. That's what Freeman saw and mapped in the year 2000. And his map led to the development of a new category of drugs called checkpoint inhibitors. These are drugs that block that PD-1/PD-L1 pathway and other similar pathways, drugs that take the brakes off the immune system and let the T cells do their job. Today, checkpoint inhibitors have been approved for more than 25 different types of cancer. Countless patients have benefited from them. However,
an average response rate is 20 to 30%, which means that it's not working for 70% of the people who take it. And so the real goal now is to bring benefit to those 70% where it's not working yet.
So that's the project now, to extend the benefits of immunotherapy to all cancer patients instead of to just a few. And the best way to do that, it seems, is by doubling down, by pairing immunotherapy with other therapies so patients can benefit from both. Sound logical? Sure. Sound easy? Not on your life. It's called combination immunotherapy, and it's what this episode is all about. I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast. The human immune system is almost indescribably complex. There are T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes, neutrophils and basophils, chemokines and cytokines and macrophages, and many other elements, each with their own roles and responsibilities. The system's great variety is one of its greatest assets. The deep arsenal enables it to fend off any number of threats, viruses, bacteria, and, quite often, cancer. But that same variety, that teeming network of cells and factors and signaling that makes up our immune system, also makes it very hard to read. And to blur the picture even more, the immune system doesn't stand still when it fights cancer. Its response changes as the tumor develops and evolves. The tissue and proteins and blood vessels surrounding the tumor, what we call the tumor microenvironment, that changes as well, often in response to treatment. The long and the short of it, the cancer that doctors treat today may be very different from the cancer they treated a year ago in the same patient. All this is to say is that sometimes trying to recruit the immune system in the war against cancer is almost like playing four-dimensional chess.
I think the PD-1 inhibition in some sense was a godsend, right?
That's Patrick Ott. He directs clinical sciences at the Center for Immuno-Oncology at Dana-Farber. He also sees patients in the clinic. Ott says that checkpoint inhibitors, the ones that take the brakes off the immune system, are more or less a miracle.
Knowing about the complexity, if you're a person who thinks like glass half empty, and sort of the more you understand, the more you comprehend the tools that in some way that the tumor has to like defend an immune attack, you could think like, how can immunotherapy ever be effective? But for some reason, I would argue that we don't fully understand why, if you block that one inhibitory pathway, which is PD-1, PD-L1, that really converts an ineffective anti-tumor immune response to an effective one.
Like the immune system it constantly tries to outwit, cancer has an equally eclectic bag of tricks to draw from. It uses those tricks to evade detection and destruction. The PD-1, PD-L1 pathway, the pathway cancer uses to deactivate our T cells, is a mainstay in that repertoire, a top 10 maneuver. And as Ott points out, targeting that single maneuver is sometimes enough. But sometimes it isn't, because there's so much more going on in the ground war between cancer and the immune system. Cancer uses other pathways to shut down our defenses, sometimes instead of and sometimes in addition to PD-1. Chemotherapy can reset the entire immune table, with dying cells releasing all sorts of signals into the bloodstream. Those signals can set off a new cascade of immune responses. And then there's drug resistance, the way tumors learn to blunt the effect of therapies we hit them with. In this broader context, a 20 or 25% response rate with immunotherapy does look like a miracle. But if it's going to fulfill its promise, immunotherapy needs backup and follow-up.
So it's great to like see a 20% response rate. The next step is like, well, why do the other 80% not respond, right? And in the beginning, sort of the notion, the field was, well, now that we have this proof of principle, we basically use PD-1 inhibition in some way that's like called as a backbone of therapy. So you basically treat a patient with PD-1 inhibition and then add on other things.
So how do we know which other things to add on to PD-1 therapy? Let's take melanoma, a disease that Ott specializes in. Melanoma also shuts down T cells. It targets a different receptor called CTLA-4. Like PD-1, CTLA-4 is a checkpoint on the T cell. When triggered, CTLA-4 deactivates the T cell. Cancer cells waltz by. Freeman's work sparked a surge in research in PD-1 and on pathways that regulate our cancer immune response. And that surge led to a wave of clinical trials of checkpoint inhibitors, drugs that could take the brakes off the immune system and help the T cell get its mojo back. In 2011, the FDA approved CTLA-4 inhibitors for treatment in metastatic melanoma. It was the first checkpoint inhibitor to gain approval. And those CTLA-4 inhibitors work pretty well alone. More than 25% of melanoma patients experience long-lasting remissions or cures. In 2014, 3 years after it approved the CTLA-4 inhibitors, the FDA approved the first PD-1 inhibitors. It was an even bigger deal. Both pathways shut down T cell activity, but CTLA-4 tends to shut them down at the early stage of disease. PD-1 works its black magic later on, when T cells start to give up after a long battle with cancer. And PD-1 controls a lot more cell signals than CTLA-4 does. So in 2014, researchers started trying the two drugs out together.
And that improved outcomes really dramatically. So PD-1 inhibition alone, CTLA-4 inhibition alone, independently were effective, but the combination was even more effective. And that became essentially standard of care for melanoma in the first line, but also was approved in other cancers, including lung cancer, bladder cancer, and kidney cancer. So as an example, that when you combine two immune checkpoint inhibitors, you can improve the efficacy.
That's one combination immunotherapy success story, where two drugs are better than one. In this case, you combine two checkpoint inhibitors, one that works on PD-1, the second that blocks CTLA-4. This two-drug combo improved outcomes in a broad range of patients across a broad range of cancers. Success stories like this one spawned thousands of clinical trials, with teams of scientists and clinicians and drug companies all searching for that elusive 1-2 punch. But not all of these trials led to a knockout victory.
There have been molecules that were targeted by, or that were, you know, investigated by many different companies, and there were, you know, successes in early trials where there was, like, you know, encouraging response rates. But there have certainly been a good number of stories where initially there was quite a bit of enthusiasm in these initial trials that didn't pan out later on when there was more rigorous randomized later stage trials.
Gordon Freeman's discovery of the PD-1/PD-L1 pathway was a milestone in cancer research and therapy, a quantum leap forward. Put in any cliche you want, it was that important. Important because this discovery demonstrated, among other things, that immunotherapy can work, that it can help our immune system, as exquisitely intricate and interconnected as it is, stare down many forms of cancer. Immunotherapy is already a big part of that help, but almost everyone in oncology believes combination immunotherapy can be an even bigger help. To that point, there are over 5,000 ongoing clinical trials for combination immunotherapy in the United States alone. There are trials that pair immunotherapy with chemotherapy, with another immunotherapy, or with drugs that block the formation of blood vessels. There are trials that combine immunotherapy with precision therapy, with drugs that target specific genetic mutations. And there are trials testing out immunotherapy prior to and following surgery. That's a lot of trials, a lot of possible combinations, outcomes, and outliers. In physics, we know that every action generates an equal and opposite reaction. In medicine, it's not quite that linear. There are just too many unknowns, too many variables, especially when testing two drugs instead of one. And with all these variables, all these possible combinations of therapies, how can clinicians know which ones are worth pursuing? Sometimes you just have to go with what you see. And that's what F. Stephen Hody did. He's a doctor at Dana-Farber, where he directs the Melanoma Center. He also directs the Center for Immuno-Oncology. In the early 2010s, Hody observed how some of his metastatic melanoma patients were doing remarkably well after they'd received checkpoint inhibitors. A prospering patient is always a welcome sight, but Hody observed something else.
When you looked at their biopsies, we actually saw that the immune system was attacking the blood vessels feeding the tumor deposits and seemed to spare normal blood vessels. And so it was kind of an interesting thought that the immune system may be selective against the blood vessels feeding tumors very specifically.
That bite requires a bit of commentary. Cancer has a whole bag of dirty tricks it uses to survive. One of these is something called angiogenesis. Angiogenesis is the creation of new blood vessels. In most circumstances in a healthy organism, angiogenesis is a healthful process. It's how we build capillaries to bring oxygen to organs and tissues. It's how we channel blood to cuts and scrapes as they heal. With cancer, though, that helpful process becomes harmful because many solid tumors also promote angiogenesis. They secrete growth factors, factors that help form dedicated blood vessels to redirect blood flow to tumors. This redirected blood helps the tumors thrive and grow. Again, all this happens at the expense of healthy tissue. What Hody saw in these patient biopsies was that after treatment with checkpoint inhibitors, the patient's immune systems seemed to be attacking the newly formed blood vessels, the ones the tumors had created to feed themselves. Once again, after these metastatic melanoma patients were treated with a checkpoint inhibitor, their jazzed-up immune systems didn't just go after the tumor cells. They went after the blood vessels the tumors built to hijack the body's blood flow. And there was more. As the immune system took aim at the blood vessels that fed the tumor, it was sparing the blood vessels that fed healthy tissue. To Hody, it looked like the immune system could tell the difference.
It was a little bit of a surprise. It was also just intriguing that the immune system was able to distinguish the blood vessels specific to the tumor, and that maybe that those blood vessels were biologically different. They expressed different proteins, they functioned different than normal blood vessels.
Hody wasn't sure how the immune system could make that distinction, but he believed it had something to do with timing and signaling. When you cut yourself, a number of things need to happen so the skin can repair itself. First, you get hemostasis. The body stops the flow of blood to the wound so the healing can begin. As part of that healing, the immune system swoops in to sweep away dead skin cells and to get rid of bacteria and other infectious agents. The next step in healing is angiogenesis, laying down the blood vessels that will supply the new skin cells. But before our bodies can take that step, the inflammation, the immune response, needs to subside.
So tumors take advantage of that because they need new blood vessels to grow, and they want to avoid immune recognition to grow. And so the interplay between angiogenesis factors, blood vessel forming factors, and the immune system seems to kind of be a two-way street, and they're kind of crosstalk with one another.
So the tumors seem to wait for the right moment to lay down their new blood vessels, right after the immune system finishes its cleanup. Any earlier, and the blood vessels will be attacked. Any later, and new skin cells and other blood vessels have already begun to take shape. It's all about timing. When the tumors sense the time is right, they secrete something called VEGF, that's vascular endothelial growth factor. VEGF is a signal protein that kicks off angiogenesis. And part of that kickoff, part of ensuring that the tumor has an adequate supply of blood, involves protecting these new blood vessels from immune attack. From previous research and from his own observations, Hody suspected that VEGF also did that, that the growth factor was also an immunosuppressant, that it deflects or diffuses the immune response so the blood vessels can take root.
We found that patients who had higher levels of VEGF in their blood before receiving CTLA-4 blockade didn't do as well as patients who had lower levels. And so there was a lot of initial pieces being put together, guilt by association, but as you put the pieces of the puzzle together, kind of indicate that maybe this would benefit from further investigation.
VEGF, the blood vessel growth factor, seemed to be muting the immune response even after patients received the checkpoint inhibitors, in this case, CTLA-4 therapy. Hody wondered whether that immune response might be more robust if VEGF was also targeted. So he led a clinical trial with combination therapy, a 1-2 punch, with a checkpoint inhibitor that would energize a patient's T cells and with an anti-angiogenic drug that would keep the tumor from laying down new blood vessels. That anti-angiogenic drug would also keep VEGF from dampening the immune response. It was a very compelling hypothesis, and the trial results showed it to be spot on. Hody saw that after some patients received the checkpoint inhibitor, this was the CTLA-4 checkpoint, their immune systems didn't just rev up their T cells, they also produced antibodies, antibodies that shut down VEGF and other angiogenic growth factors. Again, as a secondary effect of the checkpoint inhibitor, the drug that takes the brakes off the T cells, other immune cells were creating antibodies to block the formation of new blood vessels. In essence, the checkpoint inhibitor was also anti-angiogenic. There were interesting crossover results from the VEGF inhibitor as well, from the drug that shut down the blood vessel growth factor. Hody saw that when VEGF was targeted, the blood vessels around patient tumors seemed to change a bit.
They're more permissive of immune cells to cross from the blood into the tumor microenvironment. Some of the biochemistry changes, their morphology, their shape changes, and it allows the immune cells to cross into the tumor microenvironment better, which might make immune therapy better because immune cells are going to be right in the tumor microenvironment.
Let's repeat that one. Targeting VEGF didn't just help cut off the tumor blood supply. It helped T cells and their immune partners do a better job. It opened the door for tumor-fighting cells to infiltrate the tissues surrounding the tumor. Now, that's a winning combination. Two drugs with two different targets and two different mechanisms, teaming up to fight cancer on two different fronts and giving each other a helping hand.
These combinations of checkpoint blockade and the angiogenesis inhibitors have been tested in a variety of cancers, even beyond melanoma, with some really interesting and important change of practice for kidney cancer, endometrial cancer, liver cancer. I've been trying lung cancer. So this kind of concepts have broadened generally to the possibility of synergistic effects between blocking blood vessel chemicals and taking the brakes off the immune system.
Hody's trial and its encouraging results emerged from extensive tumor analysis and blood work. He started with what he saw, with physical evidence that then led to a hypothesis he could test in patients. It wasn't just a case of taking two drugs that work on their own and seeing if they might work better in tandem.
We kind of very early on had a suggestion of what the possible mechanisms are, and that blood vessel formation and all the biochemistry involved with that actually were important for the immune system, and that the two crosstalked with one another, and that you could find ways to maybe put them together to help patients.
And Hody did find a way to help patients, boosting the immune response with one drug and blocking angiogenesis with a second. And it wasn't just one and one making two. The two drugs together also changed the tumor microenvironment. Together, they made it more conducive to an immune response. It was a very impressive result. But Hody knows that the better part of the combination immunotherapy story has yet to be written.
We're learning different aspects of the immune system, the role of other immune cells besides T cells in terms of the fight against cancer. We're learning how all those immune cells interact with one another, how antibodies are involved in fighting cancer. And I think we're still, well, made great strides. We're still, I think, fairly early in our understanding of how to apply all these principles to improve therapies.
So, combination immunotherapy, it's complicated. And here's a further complication. In addition to finding out which therapies might complement each other, which drugs or treatments can work in tandem, doctors also need to figure out the optimal order of those treatments. Because these treatments change the landscape. Some chemotherapies suppress T cell activity, others give T cells an added boost. Either way, the reaction to chemo will change the way a tumor reacts to immunotherapy, and vice versa. It's not just a question of doubling down.
There's often a very standard kind of way to approach clinical combinations where we just put everything together and see what happens.
That's Lena Gandhi. She directs the Center for Therapeutic Innovation at Dana-Farber.
Which is, I think, really hard and not the right way to be approaching combinations of immunotherapies. Not only do we need to understand what is the effect of one drug on the tumor immune environment versus both, but we need to understand whether combining them together can be inferior if we're doing it in the wrong sequence.
Gandhi has led pivotal studies in combination immunotherapy, both in industry and, more recently, at Dana-Farber, where she's worked since 2020. She's interested, among other things, in therapy sequence, in discovering which treatment should lead and which should follow and after how long, and which treatments should be administered together. She cites one study in lung cancer. Patients were treated with radiation and after that with PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors. The variable was the interval between the two therapies. Some patients got the checkpoint inhibitors just 2 weeks after finishing their radiation treatments. Some waited longer between the two. The longest interval was 6 weeks. The hypothesis was that the longer wait would produce better results. Physicians had long observed that radiation seems to temporarily alter our body's immune response, that it seems to reduce inflammation in the treated area. But the hypothesis was wrong.
In fact, initially, we thought that bringing in PD-1 inhibitors immediately after radiation may not be so optimal because we often see the upregulation of T regulatory cells or other kinds of T cells that suppress T effector cells or killer T cells from actually killing the tumor. In point of fact, though, when we, at least in lung cancer, when we did those studies combining radiation with PD-1 inhibitors, we saw that actually bringing the PD-1 inhibitor even earlier after radiation actually had a better long-term effect.
And why was the hypothesis wrong? Why did the patients who waited only 2 weeks after radiation do better than the patients who waited 6 weeks? Well, the answer is, we're not sure.
It just highlights again how little we know actually about how all these different inputs are working together and that radiation may not be the same as chemotherapy plus radiation and all those kinds of things, and that we really need, honestly, to understand what's happening at the tumor microenvironment level to better design studies and combinations and sequences that might really get at what that environment is telling us it needs.
What would it take then to understand what the tumor and everything around it are saying, to decipher the language spoken in the region that Gandhi likes to call the tumor immune microenvironment?
Really, what we need to know are some three key things, which is, what are the tumor cells doing in the immune microenvironment? What are the immune cells doing, and which immune cells? And that means understanding the proteins that are being expressed by tumor cells versus immune cells, and by understanding where and which kind of immune cells are acting next to the tumor cells, because that all of that we think actually matters in generating a tumor immune response.
And then there's the matter of toxicity. Doctors have been treating cancer patients with multiple chemotherapies for decades, with excellent results and mostly manageable side effects. It's different with combination immunotherapy.
The toxicities are actually not as predictable when you put those two different kinds of drugs together as when you put two chemotherapy drugs together. I think it's really important that we, as doctors and researchers, think very carefully about what kinds of drugs we're putting together.
Just as two therapies can complement each other, can act both as single agent and as a productive partner, those same two therapies can generate adverse effects, side effects, that are stronger than the ones they might produce on their own. In lung cancer, for example, certain targeted therapies can cause an inflammation called pneumonitis. Immunotherapies can cause that same inflammation. Doctors need to be careful combining the two. But Gandhi points to other combinations where outcomes are improved and side effects are manageable.
One of the reasons that chemotherapy and combinations with immunotherapy has really taken off in many cancers is because we might have expected to see a lot worse side effects, like much more inflammation and therefore worse effects from the immunotherapy and maybe worse effects from the chemotherapy. In fact, we didn't see that. What we saw is mostly you see the effects of the chemotherapy and the predictable side effects, and you can see predictable side effects of immunotherapy, but they weren't unexpected and they weren't necessarily more.
And even in cases where doubling down on therapies has doubled down on side effects, doctors are finding ways to minimize those side effects. They do it with better timing.
And there's good examples actually in melanoma where combining BRAF inhibitors, which can have certain skin and liver toxicities, with PD-1 inhibitors and CTLA-4 inhibitors were very toxic when given together, but you could sequence them in a way that was less toxic. And it just, again, emphasizes we need to understand more about what each drug is doing to figure out the best way of combining them.
It's hard to predict when combination immunotherapy will bat 500, when it will work in 50, 60, or even 90% of patients. The list of possible combinations, sequences, and outcomes is almost infinite. We'll need thousands of additional clinical trials. We'll need the foresight to know which trials to run and the hindsight to know what those trials told us. We'll need new therapies in addition to new combinations of existing therapies. And we'll need better information and intelligence. An immune atlas that pools data about specific cancers, specific therapies, and perhaps most important of all, how those cancers change in response to those therapies. All these efforts are underway at Dana-Farber and at institutions around the world. It's a lot of work, a lot of information to gather and process, a lot more than in many other areas of research. In comparison, targeted therapy, finding a genetic mutation that causes cancer, then shutting that mutation down, is relatively straightforward.
What we did with targeted therapy was a very simple process. One mutation that's called an oncogenic driver can be the one thing you have to target for a good tumor cell killing effect.
Still, Gandhi believes combination immunotherapy will eventually work in a majority of patients. We have the capacity, we have the technologies, and we have a detailed view of cancer and its many incarnations that was unavailable even 5 years ago.
But we can apply that same data of really understanding all of the mutations that are involved, all of the cell types that are involved, and all of the proteins that are involved, and where they are, and actually use that information to guide how we develop therapies. But it's eminently doable. I think we have all the tools. We just have to apply them now in a higher order way to a tumor immune response.
Next time, doctors turn to artificial intelligence to translate mountains of data into insights and treatments.
I need you to come up with a way to find the needles in the haystack. Which of these mutations in each patient's genome is something we can act upon clinically, we can give a drug for that's actionable? Can you do this?
I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast.
What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to dana-farber.org/stories and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.